To the Bad Quaker podcast, where liberty is our mission. This is Tuesday, April 2nd, 2013, and this is podcast number 294. Now, yesterday was April 1st, and I attempted some humor. I hope it came across that way. I gave a mix of true stuff, half-true stuff, and completely not true, the total opposite of true. And I hope you took it as as humor. I thought afterwards, and I mentioned this in our forum. I thought, we have more and more people are starting to listen to the Bad Quaker podcast in Eastern Europe and in other countries, and I'm not sure exactly how widespread the April 1st nonsense is. So, but then one of the people in the forum, a real faithful listener, corrected me and said, no, that's an old, even a pre-Christian ritual that goes back, and a lot of people in Europe know about it. So anyway, yesterday was a blend of fake stuff and real stuff. The first retraction, so I'm going to give a bunch of retractions and explanations of yesterday to start off with. First off, of course, Porkfest 10 is still going, June 17th through 23rd at the Rogers Campground in Lancaster, New Hampshire. That's still going. The Free State Project did not move to Delaware. Oddly enough, I made that up. And the Seacoast Annual Freedom Expo in Exeter, New Hampshire at the Exeter Town Hall is still set for Saturday, April 27th. The Democratic Party of New Hampshire did not get a restraining order against Fun. I made that up. Also, the first annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, hosted by the Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition, will be taking place at Brightonton Recreation Area in Brightonton, Michigan. And I'm probably mispronouncing that. So get down there Friday, Saturday, and or up there, actually. Michigan is north of most people, probably, in the U.S. But get up there to Michigan on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, August 17th, 18th, and 19th of this year. Now, it's going to be right there in the middle of August, the middle of summer, the middle of heat. Michigan may not be, perfectly comfortable 68 degrees with a nice, breeze. But it's certainly going to be cooler than most places with all, in all likelihood, than most places in the U.S. So it'll be a nice weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. My wife and I are planning on taking our motorhome and coming up there. And we hope to have fun. Hope to see you there. And the registration is open for that. I'll put a link in today's show notes for the link where you sign up to register. And unfortunately, it's 3 days. It's at a state campground, a Michigan state campground that's there. And it's not cheap, unfortunately. But it should be a lot of fun. And, you can cut your expenses a bit by, it's pretty expensive even if you use a tent, but do what you can. Get up there, we'll have a lot of fun. And some of the things that I said yesterday that were true and some were false, I actually did get an email from Mark in Ontario, and that whole discussion of his email was all correct. And so all the talk about IP, if IP were enforced, in reality, if IP were a legitimate thing and were enforced to its logical end, all of that was real. There'd be no rock and roll, there'd be no jazz, there'd be no blues, there'd be no pop music. You know, the stealing of the four chord repetitions over and over in all these kinds of music, all of that would not be allowed if IP were taken to its logical end. So all that was serious. Everything that I said about the IP and about the email was true. And I was reading about Christian anarchism in Wikipedia, and all of that was true. So all the stuff that I was talking about with that, and then all the stuff that I talked about, quotes attributed to Albert Einstein, that was all true. Everything that I read about and spoke about wiki quotes, the quote first appearing in Wildlife Management Institute, publication by them, all of that stuff was true. The actual quote that I actually read from New York Times Magazine by Einstein, where he says basically that we have no choice, we're going to have a one-world government. That's all true, and it's important to realize that, you know, he was not looking at, it's not that he was this horrible statist monster who wanted a one-world government to dominate everyone and take their guns. It's not like that. Einstein was simply looking at things, and from his point of view, which is, well, the state's not the best in the world, but it's the best we got, and this is what we have to work with. So if you just take that logic out to its furthest extent, and I've said this lots of times, if you believe that the state is a good thing, or even if you just believe that it's tolerable, or if it's the best system that we have, or the best system we have hope for, if you believe any of those things, then as Einstein pointed out in his article with New York Times Magazine, the logical conclusion is that eventually this thing will come to a point where there will be one government throughout the entire world. I mean, it's just a logical conclusion. It's watching the thing and just assuming that it's going to continue exactly like it's always continued, and it's going to consolidate more and more power into smaller and smaller groups. So it's only logical that it's going to become into that condition. And that is my assumption. My assumption is that individual nation states like the United States, like Canada, like Mexico, like, you know, whatever, will either actually fall, or they will be absorbed, sort of the way the European Union is absorbing power and absorbing, consolidating governmental actions in Europe. The same thing's going to happen in North America. The same thing's going to happen across Europe. And the same thing's going to eventually happen with South America and, you know, Africa and so forth. It's the only logical choice. And some of these places are going to be horribly oppressed, you know, while other places are going to be relatively more. The government will be more benign in some places as opposed to other places. But it's still going to be like that. And the stages before it gets there of individual governments falling, you know, it's just a logical progression of how this stuff works. And then, you know, I'm pretty convinced in my mind that the U.S. government will eventually fall. I don't know when, 50, you know, 20, 50, 100 years, whatever. But eventually, I'm pretty sure it's going to fall. But when it falls, it will immediately be replaced by something else, some kind of a, you know, a North American Union has been talked about. I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities here. But as this takes place, again, the logical end is a one-world government. And then the logical end of that is for that government to fail like every other one ever has. Now, this process, well, like I say, might take 50, it might take 100 years, might take 500 years. But however much time it takes, as we, as anarchists, refine what it is we believe and what it is we understand, and we prepare and we teach, then when the time comes that the ultimate state collapses, that concept that I talk about, not just the individual government itself, when all governments have failed, then the concept of the state will be what is in challenge. And it will be a question of, do we set up another government, or do we evaluate this in a different way and see if maybe we're doing something wrong by just repeating the same mistake? So when that takes place, then it's up to us to sell the new product. It's up to us to bring the light bulb to the people who are still using whaling oil. Or it's up to us to bring, you know, the automobile to those who are still riding horses. It's up to us to bring a purified anarchical thinking to those who are stuck in the state and offer them a better market product. And that's how we win. And this brings me to my next point. You know, yesterday in my joke podcast, I mentioned that David Friedman, the economist, the legendary economist, the legendary anarcho-capitalist, David Friedman, has joined the Bad Quaker Forum, and I was engaging in him with conversation where he had taken me to task on some things. Well, all that's true. David Friedman, the real David, there are a lot of people named David Friedman, by the way, but the real David Friedman has been engaging me in a conversation on the Bad Quaker Forum, and you can go over there even without making an identity. You can just go in as a visitor and read that. You can find it in the general discussion section, and it's titled Hate and Dishonesty, Your Critique of My Response to Rothbard's Argument. That really is there, and it really is the actual David Friedman. All of that was true that I said yesterday. He is the David Friedman. Now, and here's an interesting thing, and if I ever talk to him in person, I want to rib him about this a little bit. David Friedman, to my knowledge, David Friedman is the only actual anarchist to start a war in the 20th century. Now you might kind of scratch your head for a minute and you say, what in the world are you talking about? Ben, you're going nuts. No, David Friedman, to my knowledge, and there are a lot of people that have been, called anarchists, but to my knowledge, David Friedman is the only real anarchist, specifically the only anarcho-capitalist, to start a war during the 20th century. It's the Pendzig War. David Friedman, the same David Friedman, the economist, the son of Milton Friedman, the father of Petri Friedman, that David Friedman was one of the founders of the Pendzig War. And if you're not sure what the Pendzig War is, it's a very large staged costume battle that takes place every year in Pennsylvania. It's the largest annual SCA event, and I think it's pretty neat. Pretty much anybody who knows anything about Renaissance fairs knows who the SCA is and knows how they get together and recreate the Renaissance era in our time. So anyway, so that's an interesting thing about David Friedman. Now let me move on to my more disclaimers of yesterday's joke podcast. What I said about Kai is true. She actually did call, checked in from the Appalachian Trail, and they want $20 for her to just walk through the woods on a trail that is not maintained by the government in any way. It's maintained voluntarily, and the government still wants $20 extortion fee just for her to walk through the area. So now more disclaimers from yesterday. I really kind of, because of the surreality, is that right? Because of the bizarre nature of the argument, I sort of took reality and fantasy and blended it together to talk about the problems that my friend Eddie Free is having with this, the guy I was referring to as the Jesus freak. The guy really is a nut. I'm not convinced he really is a Jesus freak, as I was using the phrase yesterday. I think he's one of these people that just uses Jesus and God constantly as an excuse for their actions. I really believe that's really a better description of this guy. I don't think he believes any of his of his con that he puts out. But yeah, he actually did on the internet, verbally, was very brutal with Eddie, spread all kinds of lies all over the internet about him, just horrible lies too. And he actually did, this nut actually did threaten this gentleman, Estes Conway, or Eustace Conway. He actually threatened that guy and said that he was going to go out there and hurt him if Eddie didn't do what he wanted. He actually said this over the internet. Now, you might think, well, why didn't Eddie call the cops? Because Eddie is an honest man, and Eddie is not going to call one violent gang of thugs to go and take care of another violent gang of thugs. That's why Eddie didn't call the police, and I applaud him for that. But that is all true. He claimed that this nutcase claimed that God had told him to set up this charity. And evidently, like I said, evidently his God doesn't know about Google, because then his God would have known that there's already a charity, a legitimate charity, and that Eddie was already running the Facebook website and everything like this. So anyway, so that was entirely, even though I embellished it a bit and tried to make it as comedic as possible, that was really true. Eddie really did face that kind of anger from this guy. And there's other stuff on the internet, like there's YouTube videos of this guy just screaming through traffic, cutting people off, almost running over pedestrians, almost hitting bikers. Just, I mean, this guy is just not a good person. Okay, so more disclaimers of yesterday. As it turns out, North Korea did not launch missiles at the U.S., and the cities of Bakersfield, Tulsa, Hoboken, Walla Walla, Wichita, Tuscaloosa, and even Roswell, New Mexico, are entirely safe. They are not under missile attack by North Korea. So I'm sure that really settles a lot of people's hearts when they hear that that was made up, huh? Because I'm sure you really believed that yesterday, didn't you? Another thing that I talked about yesterday was about Google having Cesar Chavez as their doodle on Easter Sunday, and I totally made up the part about this wacko idiot that's been harassing Eddie Free. I totally made up the part about him threatening about the Google thing. I made that up. I made it all about the that Patrick Friedman had to shut down Google and all that. I totally made that up. That was just that was embellishment on my part for the fun of April Fool's Day. And the other thing that I didn't make up, but it was part of April Fool's, was that Eddie Free's having a baby. And then, we added to it different people on Facebook and me and in my podcast and so forth, and switched it around that Eddie Free was actually pregnant. And of course, Eddie Free's not having a baby. Eddie Free is not pregnant. There's no scientific study that needs to be that needs to take place to investigate that. And, of course, that means, as I mentioned in the beginning, I probably will see Eddie at Porkfest, because Porkfest is on, it's not off, and the New Hampshire, the Free State Project has not abandoned New Hampshire, they have not moved to Delaware, so there will be a Porkfest, and I think that wraps up all the stuff that I talked about, that I made up for April Fool's Day yesterday. Oh, no, one other thing. The pooping event in New Hampshire was made up as well. That came from a joke on Facebook that someone had already set that up and had the joke going on Facebook, and I just added to it and stole the concept from them. So there was no defecation protest in New Hampshire yesterday. That was entirely a Facebook joke. Now I'm going to break for a commercial, and when I get back, I want to talk about something that's referred to often as the Battle of Athens, happened in 1946, and so I'm going to talk about the Battle of Athens when I come back from this break. Stick with me, I'll be right back. From June 17th through June 23rd of this year, the Free State Project will celebrate its 10th annual Porcupine Freedom Festival, Porkfest. My wife Cindy and I plan on attending, and Bad Quaker staff members Hannah and Matt are trying to raise enough money to attend, as they did last year. Considering fuel, campground fees, and Porkfest tickets, we estimate it will cost BadQuaker.com a little over $2,000 for Cindy and I to attend. For Matt and Hannah to attend, it will cost about $700 more. If you'd like to take part in sending the Bad Quaker crew to Porkfest 10, here's how you can do it. Go to badquaker.com. You can click on the donate button on the right-hand side of the page. You can also give us bitcoins with our bitcoin number located right below the donate button, or you can use our Amazon button to shop at Amazon. If you'd like to support BadQuaker.com on a regular basis, you can use the link to our forum and become a supporting member for only $4 a month or just $25 a year. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break, and I was going to talk about the Battle of Athens. So if you go to Wikipedia, and Wikipedia has a pretty good overview of the Battle of Athens. If you go to Wikipedia, and I'll put a link on today's show to the Battle of Athens page on Wikipedia. If you go there, you'll see that it says the Battle of Athens, sometimes called the McMinn County War was a rebellion led by citizens in Athens and Etowah, Tennessee, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Now, the problem with this is that it was not a rebellion. You know, Wikipedia's throwing that word around. Whoever added that in Wikipedia needs to pull that out of there. I've stopped trying to fix Wikipedia, so I don't even mess with it too much anymore. But it was not a rebellion. That's, you know, words like that are used regularly to distort events. People talk about the war that happened in the U.S. between 1861 and 1865, was it? They call that a civil war. Well, there's no possible way you can define what happened in that time frame in the U.S. as a civil war. The southern states, the Confederacy, was not in any way attempting to overthrow the government or take over Washington, D.C., or in any other way replace the existing government. That was not what they were trying to do. They were attempting to, you know, break away from the United States and become separate. So it was a divisive war. Certainly it was a horrible war in many ways, but it was not a civil war. It wasn't a rebellion. It wasn't a civil war. It was, you know, technically it was an act of aggression on the part of the United States against its individual states. But even if you try to take the opinion that, you know, that the United States government had the right to use aggression against the states to hold them within, then that takes us to another war that's misnamed that I've talked about often. The Revolutionary War was not a revolution. There was nobody in the colonies that were attempting to overthrow the British government or take Parliament or throw out the king. None of that was taking place. It was not a revolution. It was a war of independence. It was a war of one group of people who are geographically divided by the people that were ruling over them, and they were attempting to become an independent group, specifically 13 independent states. That was the whole purpose of the war. And it was not in any way a revolution. It was a war of independence. And if you understand that about that war that took place in 1776, then it's really difficult to describe the war that happened during the Lincoln administration as anything other than a war of independence. It was an attempt at the southern states at independence. And if you say that the war that took place in 1776 was good and just because the colonists were attempting to break away from the high taxation and the tyranny that is listed in the Declaration of Independence. If you believe that, and if you think that that was good, that they attempted to bring independence to the 13 colonies and become 13 states, then how is it that you would think that the war that took place in Lincoln's time, how would you think that the Lincoln administration was justified in marching into the South and essentially conquering it, if what they were trying to do was this exact same thing? They were geographically divided, they were culturally divided, and they were attempting to get out from underneath horribly repressive taxes that were about to go up dramatically by multiplying effects. It was the tariff was something like, if I recall, it was something in the low teens or something like that, and it was going to be taken up to like almost 40% tariff on southern goods. If I recall, I've done the series on the wars already, so I'm just going by memory. I don't have notes on that, but there was going to be a dramatic, crushing tax that Lincoln had promised, and he even said this in his first inaugural address, that if there's a division between the North and South, it has nothing to do with slavery, because he's not going to in any way try to force the Northern views of slavery onto the South. He said that numerous times, including in his inaugural address. The whole point of the war was to inflict the taxes upon the South. And Lincoln said that openly at the time. He never claimed that it was about slavery. So when you misname things like this, whether we're talking about the so-called Civil War or the so-called Revolutionary War, when you allow government to teach children to rename these things, you know, in the way that the government wants them renamed, there are ripple effects. There are long-term damages done to the way people think about an event, and you know the mind is pushed in the way that the government wants the mind pushed. So no, the Revolutionary War was a war of independence. It was not a revolutionary war. And Lincoln's war was not a civil war. It was a war of aggression on the part of the North attempting to stop the independence of the South. Now, as far as this thing that happened in Athens in 1946, there was in no way can you call it a rebellion. It was a difficult situation. I wouldn't have wanted to be there, but it was not a rebellion. It doesn't have any of the necessary characteristics to call it a rebellion. So what was the Battle of Athens? Well, essentially what you had in Athens, Tennessee at the time, or actually in the county of McMinn, in McMinn County, Tennessee, what you had was you had a group of corrupt politicians who had held power there for about 10 or 15 years, and you had a corrupt sheriff's department that worked hand in hand with those corrupt politicians to both maintain power and, basically to inflict their will upon the residents and, glean a pretty good living off of them at the same time. So what are some of the things that were going on? Well, there was the typical corruption you have among politicians. And let me just say, too, that what was going on in McMinn County at that time in Tennessee was not all that unusual. It was there were many places in the U.S. that were facing the exact kind of corruption. That kind of thing happened long before there was a McMinn County, and it's happening. It's been happening on and off in counties and rural areas all the time ever since. It's an aspect of local government. It's not at all unusual. It happens every time that type of people get the opportunity to do it. So we had corrupt politicians and a corrupt sheriff's department. The sheriff's department ran a protection racket, essentially, for the local brothels and, charged them a piece of the cut for their protection racket. The sheriff's deputies would actually get paid per arrest. Now, not per conviction. They got paid every time someone was arrested and the paperwork was run through on the arrest. So all they had to do was arrest you and then turn you loose, and the deputy got paid for that. Well, of course, that encouraged the deputies to arrest people for pretty much anything. So, for example, anybody just passing through the county would be very likely to be pulled over in their car and arrested. For anything. It didn't matter. They'd arrest you for whatever they felt like arresting you for, because it didn't matter. Even if it never went to trial, the deputy still got paid. And they didn't have police forces in that county. The sheriff's deputies ran the whole county. There were only about 15 deputies and one sheriff involved in this. So the other thing that the sheriffs did was they had strict control of the elections. They would literally have deputies in the polling places to intimidate the voters to, keep the corrupt politicians elected, keep out anybody that they knew would vote in the wrong direction, this kind of thing. Also very typical. I think a lot of people don't realize how corrupt American politics have always been. Right from the days when George Washington was running for president, and he being the largest whiskey distiller in the United States at the time, and he would provide barrels of whiskey at the polling places and pay off his friends to come and vote for him with a mug of whiskey. Now, this is not just a wild accusation. This is a historical fact. You can look it up. So corrupt elections are not the one-off thing in American history. Anybody who followed the Ron Paul campaign in 2012 should have been able to see this. Corrupt elections are, operation as usual. That's the way it's done in the U.S. and always has been. So here we have in McMinn County, the elections are being controlled by the sheriff and the sheriff's deputies. They run the local, protection racket for the brothels and the bars and so forth. They're just ticketing anybody they want for anything they want. Passerbys, a bus travels through, like a Greyhound bus, that kind of a bus comes through the county. They'd pull it over and ticket people on the bus just because they get paid to. I mean, that's how they get paid. So that's what you get when you do that. So this came to a head in between 1945 and 1946, when somewhere around 3,000 veterans returned back to their home county from at the end of World War II. So you got about 3,000 veterans coming into the county, and they've spent the last few years away from all the corruption and away from the harassment and away from the tyranny, and they've been pretty. Soldiers face a lot, and when they come home, very often they like to relax, they like to try to get their mind off of what they've experienced, and very often they might take a drink or two, and they might want to hang around and joke around and be loud and sometimes be obnoxious and sometimes just, make a fuss. Sometimes they like to do that. And so this was an opportunity for the sheriff's department to make some serious money. So what the deputies would do is they would hang out around the bars and so forth, and they would catch veterans coming out of the bars, and they would jump them and beat them up and arrest them. And then maybe all charges would be dropped or whatever, it didn't matter. The deputies got paid for every time that they arrested one of these guys. So the harassment, the veterans weren't taking this harassment very well. You know, the rest of the people had lived under it for so many years that they had kind of become browbeaten, and they looked the other way. As long as the boot is not on your neck, people have a tendency to look the other way. But these veterans were not very pleased about coming back and being harassed like this. So when the elections came up in August of 1946, the veterans got together and formed a thing called the GI Nonpartisan League. And they decided to get their people elected into all the key county positions, kick the sheriff out, kick the deputies out, and basically take control of the county. So when the election day arrived in 1946, the sheriff's department, to counter this threat, got 200 armed deputies from surrounding counties. Now, what this tells me is that the surrounding counties were doing pretty much the same thing, and they were just as corrupt. Those deputies coming in from the other counties were running essentially the same rackets as the ones that were in McMinn County. The only difference is they didn't have their racket disturbed like the one in the racket in McMinn County because of the veterans. So we have about 200 armed deputies all stationed in the polling places in order to make sure and control who gets to vote and who doesn't vote and, intimidate people, this kind of thing. Well, the vets didn't like this very much. And so there were some scuffles. At one point, one of the vets got shot in the back. It didn't kill him, but he got shot in the back by one of the deputies. And the situation very quickly, the deputies were losing control. After all, 200 deputies might be an impressive, group, an impressive force at an election. But you get like 3,000 veterans and 200 deputies don't mean much. So when things turn bad, the deputies, about 50 or 55 of them, actually grabbed the ballot boxes and ran to the local jail to hide out and defend themselves and defend the ballot boxes. Well, the vets jumped on this opportunity. They surrounded the jail. Essentially, there was a siege, and they used dynamite to blow the front door off of the jail, and the deputies surrendered. Now, there's some question about how long this took. If it took, there was a lot of shooting. There was shooting back and forth. Nobody was actually killed, but there was a lot of shooting and there was this dynamiting. And so it's questionable how long this took place, from a couple hours to a lot of hours. It's stories are not consistent on that. So eventually the ballot boxes were recovered, opened, the ballots were counted, and the veterans took over the county, took over the deputies were forced to resign, the sheriff was forced to resign, and the GI Nonpartisan League put all their people into all the key positions in the county. Now, this happened, like I say, in August of 1946, and 5 months later, in January, actually on January 4th of 1947, 5 months later, four of the five leaders of the GI Nonpartisan League declared in an open letter, and this is a quote, "We abolished one machine only to replace it with another and more powerful one in the making." So what they admitted, 5 months after this is over, four of the five leaders of the group admitted that they basically took out the old boss to put in the new boss, and it's the same thing, except the new one's going to be worse. Now, there's a really important lesson here. The Battle of Athens is often used by supporters of the Second Amendment or people that are afraid of the government, taking away your guns or taking away your ammo or taking... The Battle of Athens is always used as an example of why American citizens need to be armed and they need to be prepared to combat tyranny like this. The problem is, what did they accomplish at the Battle of Athens? Well, according to four out of the five leaders of the movement, they accomplished absolutely nothing. They put a worse group in than the group that they kicked out. So what good did it do? What good was the effort? And this is not unusual. This is how it goes. This is the rule. This is how rebellion always goes. If you want to call that rebellion, that wasn't really a rebellion. But it was just an exchanging of one tyrannical group for another. Because once the power gets into your hands, it's like I've talked about the Lord of the Rings reference. It's not the individual. It's the ring of power that corrupts. And some are corrupted quicker, and some are corrupted with, far less power than others. But in any situation, when you acknowledge that certain people have authority that the other certain people don't have, you've made a serious mistake, and you're setting up a guaranteed tyranny. And this goes back to what I was talking about with Einstein and... of him basically saying, of course it's logical there's going to be a one-world government. It has to get down to that. And then I take that a step further and I say, yes, that will happen. Eventually there will be a one-world government, not because of some, evil conspiracy or whatever. It's because it's the logical path of government. Government always, consolidates more and more power. And as it does this, it gets more tyrannical, and it gets less tolerable, and more people want seek liberty and want freedom, and that's all good, and that's the trick. That's what we do, is we refine our story, we refine our knowledge of anarchy until the time comes that the myth of the state is exposed, governments around the world collapse, and humanity says, what do? And we offer a better product. We offer a better product than the state, and the market will demand freedom. And it's not that great of a stretch. It's not that stretch of imagination. You don't have to, you don't have to have any conspiracy theories. You don't have to have. It's just the obvious thing. It's the state taken to its obvious solution, to its obvious end. Okay, I'm going to break for another commercial, and when I get back, I'm going to play a recording from a couple years ago from an article that I did, and then recorded the article. So it's a little blast from the past. You're going to get to hear me talking a couple of years ago, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. Stick with me. I'll be right back. Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you. How to Destroy the Meaning of a Word by Ben Stone. For anyone who has spent very much time investigating the nature and habits of the state, one thing should stand out. The state seems to be fascinated with distorting the meaning of words and phrases, particularly those words or phrases that the state deems dangerous or against its interests. An example of this would be, quote, Social Security. Prior to the 1930s, if you said someone was socially secure, it was an indication that they possessed independent wealth, or at least the ability to produce wealth without the dependence of others. Someone could be considered socially secure if they had inherited a large sum of money, or even if they owned stock in a mine that was consistently producing. Or Social Security could be a description of a person who had a major stake in a general store, let's say, that produced a steady profit. However used, it inferred financial independence. Of course, this is a direct threat to the state, so for all those of us who grew up after the 1930s, Social Security means dependence on the government dole and a paltry income barely at the poverty level. In other words, it used to mean the state couldn't control you. Now it means the state owns you. The word homestead has suffered a similar fate. John Locke used the word to describe the act of taking unowned or raw property and utilizing it in a productive manner, thereby establishing ownership of said property. So then, if you found land that no one else had ownership of, and you cleared it and planted a garden or an orchard, you homesteaded that land. This definition immediately rang true and obvious to the honest thinker, but it cast doubt upon the legitimacy of land claims on faraway continents by kings who had never visited them. The state couldn't allow this message to catch on, so it sprang into action to both embrace and pervert the word. Within a few short years, the simple act of surveying land became acceptable to the state to claim utilization of land and thereby ownership. But before this happened, some 500,000 Ulster Scots and displaced Presbyterians from Scotland and the English border moved into the no man's land of Appalachia, built cabins and barns, planted fields, and scratched out a mark of ownership on land no one else was suited to tame. This would be a good point in our narrative to introduce an opportunistic young man whose father died when he was only 11, leaving him to be raised on his brother's inherited farm in the shadow of the powerful Thomas Fairfax estate, so-called Lord Fairfax. I can't help but think that much of young George Washington's drive for glory came from being the second-rate half-brother gazing across the fence at the estate of one of the most powerful families in Virginia. As a young man, George found he could make a good living using his talent as a surveyor for the Fairfax family. Being a talented surveyor in those days meant having the opportunity to influence how raw property was divided among the richest families in Virginia. This often resulted in the surveyor being privy to information about available land in desirable locations ripe for, quote, homesteading. Our ambitious George eventually acquired something in excess of 52,000 acres as a result of his talent as a surveyor. And today, far more Americans recognize the name of Washington as belonging to a man and Fairfax as a place. In the years following the French and Indian War, wealthy and well-connected gentlemen began the practice of surveying occupied land and then claiming ownership of that land by the king's proclamation. Very quickly, this small group of, quote, land speculators and gentry swallowed up the prime land east of the Appalachian Mountains, while the rightful occupants were told they would have to pay a yearly quit rent to stay on their own farms. It's unclear how much George utilized this easy path to steady income as his portfolio of land ownership blossomed, but as good properties became more scarce, George and his fellow speculators began attempting to bring their version of land management into Appalachia and beyond into the rich Ohio Valley. The problem was that the Scotch-Irish occupants of Appalachia had played this game before in Ulster, and even before that on the English-Scotch border, and they were determined to win this time around. Even though Washington didn't realize it then, the King of England may well have saved George's life with his Royal Proclamation of 1763, which forbid land grabs west of the Allegheny Mountains. Between the nasty hillbillies with their fancy Kentucky rifles, cutting-edge technology of the day, and the king's refusal to acknowledge the land titles, Washington was forced to change his business model. Very quickly, the clever young man figured out a new scheme. The way he saw it, eventually the king's proclamation would either be lifted or would have no force behind it. Perhaps George could see the change coming, or perhaps he just knew that kings are temperamental and rarely hold to one view. Either way, George decided that the more of the Ohio Valley he could survey, the better he would be when the proclamation fell away. In 1767, George sent a letter to his partner William Crawford in regards to a land surveying scheme in Ohio, and it read in part, quote, "All of this can be carried on by silent management and can be carried out by you under the guise of hunting game, which you may, I presume, effectually do. At the same time, you're in pursuit of the land. When this is fully discovered, advise me of it, and if there appears to be a possibility of succeeding, I will have the land surveyed to keep others off and leave the rest to time and my own assurity." End quote. So Washington twisted the rules of not only homesteading, but of the existing state. Just so I'm not accused of picking on Washington, a few years later, once Thomas Jefferson was president of the fledgling United States, a deal was struck to fund the cash-desperate Napoleon by the sale of the so-called Louisiana Territory. There was a catch with this priced too-good-to-be-true deal. Almost forgotten now, the borders of the Louisiana Purchase were anything but agreed upon. Spain had a much older claim for much of the land, and England and Russia both had a better claim to some of it than France. So the Louisiana Purchase didn't secure the ownership of the land in the eyes of many Americans, and certainly not in the eyes of the British and the Spanish and the Russians or the French living in North America. The raw land was still up for grabs until surveyed. Jefferson desperately scrambled to secure the, quote, rightful ownership as quickly as possible by sending a troop of semi-military surveyors, explorers, and amateur naturalists across the purchased land and well beyond to the Pacific Ocean. The Lewis and Clark expedition did two things. It claimed the land for the U.S. federal government, and it grabbed the land not included in the Louisiana Purchase west of Great Falls and the Three Forks. This action presented the observer of the state an interesting phenomenon. The state, without the luxury of an actual monarch, claimed to own land by way of homesteading. In the past, it could be argued that the state owned property because the monarch was a specific person who was the head of state. But with the Lewis and Clark expedition, a non-person was attempting to claim ownership of land. This is a radical departure from Locke's original definition of homesteading. Not only have we abandoned the practice of improving the land and transforming it for production, now we have the land being owned by a non-human entity. If a king's claim on land he had never seen seemed weak, how strong is the argument that an entity that exists only in our imaginations can somehow own land? At the time, the average American failed to notice the significance of this event. There was still plenty of land available because the federal government was only actually claiming exclusive ownership of the land its agents had specifically surveyed. Therefore, the bulk of the West was still open for homesteading. It's true, Washington, D.C. was sending out teams of surveyors who were scooping up all the best land as fast as possible, but the country was so big that it wasn't hard to find a good plot where the surveyors hadn't trod. So waves of pioneers expressed independence in its purest form. Free of taxes, regulations, and silly laws, Americans made their new society without anyone's permission. Homesteading became a threat to the dominance of the state yet again. As anyone familiar with the nature of the state knows, independence is the eternal enemy of tyranny. So something had to be done to stop these wild pioneers. The Preemption Act of 1841 fit the bill nicely. On its surface, it appeared to be a way pioneers could homestead land already owned by the state. But in reality, it was simply a step on the path of destroying homesteading. This is a typical trick of the state. First, forbid something, and then, when enough of a fuss is made, allow the thing under conditions guaranteed to strengthen the position of the state. So, from 1841 until 1862, a convoluted version of Locke's vision was officially legal. Then the Homesteading Act came along and, with eminent domain, became a direct tool for the federal government to reward its big money banking, lumber, and railroad supporters while punishing any individual who stood in the way of, who stood in the path of state dominance. One would think homesteading on state land with state permission is as far removed from Locke's original concept as the word could possibly be twisted to mean. Not so. Today, cities and counties are offering discounts on quit rent, now they call it property tax, through something they call a, quote, homestead classification. Favored voting blocks of homeowners, generally retirees on Social Security, are offered tax advantages and sometimes lowered utility bills in return for supporting higher taxes and school levies on working homeowners and renters. The state is downright amazing. It's able to take, quote, homesteading and turn it into a way to extract quit rent. You have to appreciate an enemy with that kind of audacity. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.